39. Toolmaker. Milgram remembered Union Square from 20 years before, when it had been a place of broken benches and litter, where a corpse might go unremarked amid the huddled and unmoving bodies of the homeless. It had been a flagrant drug bazaar in those days, when Milgram himself had had no need of such a place. But now it was Barnes & Noble, Circuit City, Whole Foods, Virgin, and he, Milgram, had gone equally far, it sometimes seemed, in the opposite direction. Addicted, not to put too fine a point on it, to substances countering a tension at the core of his being, something wound too tightly, perpetually threatening to collapse his person, imploding, as though a Buckminster Fuller tensegrity structure contained one element that perpetually tightened itself counter to the balance of forces required to sustain it. That was the experiential nature of the thing, though he was still capable, in the abstract, of considering the possibility that the core anxiety, as he knew it today, was in part an artifact of the substance. Be that as it may, he decided, as Brown parked the silver Corolla on the south side of East 17th, just short of Union Square West, the extra dose of Japanese pharmaceutical he'd treated himself to had certainly brightened things up, not to mention the unexpectedly fine weather. Could Brown park here? Milgram wondered. It didn't look like it. But after announcing to his throat mic, or his inner demons, perhaps, that Red Team One was on the scene, Brown hauled up his black bag from the floor behind Milgram's seat and drew out a pair of licenses, drably official-looking and encapsulated in long rectangular suction-mount envelopes of some transparent but slightly yellowed plastic. Transit Authority, in black sans-serif caps. Milgram watched as Brown licked a thumb, spreading spit on the concave faces of the two suction cups on one of these and pressed it against the inside of the top of the windshield, directly above the steering wheel. He lowered the bag back down behind Milgram's seat, on top of his laptop. He turned to Milgram, producing his handcuffs, the two bracelets displayed in his palm as though he were about to suggest that Milgram purchase them. They were as professionally lusterless as his other favorite things. Did they make handcuffs out of titanium? Milgram wondered. If not, these had a sort of faux titanium finish, like the faux Oakley sunglasses they sold on Canal Street.
I said I wasn't going to cuff you into the car, Brown said.
No, Milgram agreed, carefully neutral. You said you were going to need them.
You don't know what to say if a cop or a traffic warden shows up and asks what you're doing here.
Brown snapped the cuffs back into their little form-fitting plastic holster on his belt. Help me, I've been kidnapped, Milgram thought. Or better, the trunk of this car is full of plastic explosives.
You're going to sit on a bench, enjoy the sun, Brown said.
Right, said Milgram. Brown unlocked the doors, and they both got out.
Keep your hands on the roof of the car, Brown said.
Milgram did, while Brown opened the rear door on his side and bent in to secure the second Transit Authority tag on the inside of the rear window. Milgram stood with his palms flat on the clean, warm roof of the Corolla. Brown straightened up, closing the door. He clicked his key, locking the car.
This way,
Brown said. Then something else, something Milgram didn't catch, probably in his role as Red Team One. Brown's laptop, Milgram thought. The bag. Rounding the corner and finding the park spread before them, Milgram squinted, unready for space, light, trees on the verge of leafage, the cheery canvas huddle of the Green Market. Sticking close, he followed Brown across Union Square West and into the Green Market, passing young mothers with ATV-wheeled strollers and plastic bags of organic goodies, then down past that WPA-era building he remembered, now apparently a restaurant, but closed. They came to the path that crossed the park at 16th, with Lincoln atop his plinth at its center. Milgram remembered trying to figure out what it was that Lincoln held at his side, in his left hand. A folded newspaper?
Right here,
said Brown, indicating the bench nearest Union Square West, on the south side of the path.
Not in the center. Here.
He pointed to a spot directly beside the circular armrest, designed to be deliberately inhospitable to the back of any weary head. Milgram sat, gripping the armrest to do so, as Brown pulled a skinny strip of shiny black plastic out of the waistband of his trousers, whipped it adroitly around the armrest and Milgram's wrist, and fastened it, tightening it with a sharp zipping sound. This left about a foot of excess plastic protruding from the cuff Brown had formed. He twisted this out of the way, making it less evident, and straightened up.
"We'll collect you later. Keep your mouth shut."
"Okay," said Milgram, craning his neck to watch Brown walk quickly south, his back to the green market. Milgram blinked, processing, seeing the Corolla's curbside rear window shatter. That delicious instant just before it fell into countless fragments. If you were careful, the alarm might not even sound. You could lean in over the ragged edge of glass and snag the strap on Brown's bag, wherein, Milgram was certain, would be found the brown paper bag of Rise, and walk away. Milgram looked down at the narrow black band of unbreakable plastic around his wrist. He adjusted the cuff on the Paul Stewart coat to make his situation less obvious to passers-by. If Brown were using ordinary hardware department cable ties, which this looked to be, Milgram knew how to release it. The milky, translucent flexicuffs the NYPD used, he knew from experience, were not as easily unfastened. Had Brown not wanted to carry anything that wasn't black or titanium, he wondered? Milgram had briefly shared an apartment in the East Village with a woman who'd kept an emergency supply of Valium in an aluminum fishing tackle box. The box's latch had a hole through which a small padlock could have been inserted, but she'd preferred to seal it with a plastic cable tie, a slightly smaller version of the tie that now tethered Milgram to this bench. When it was necessary to access the supply, Milgram had determined, she'd snip the tie with pliers or nail clippers, replacing it with a fresh one when she needed to reseal the box. This procedure made little sense, Milgram had observed, but people did tend to be eccentric about their drugs. He'd supposed that the ties, like an embossed wax seal on a letter, provided proof that she was the last to have opened the box. Milgram had looked for her supply of ties, the simplest way to bypass this, but hadn't been able to find it. He had, however, determined that cable ties are actually closed with a tiny molded internal ratchet. Once he'd learned to insert the flat tip of a jeweler's screwdriver, he'd been able to open and close her ties at will, even if she'd snipped them off short, as she tended to do. The fact of his pilfering had quickly put that particular relationship behind him, but now he leaned forward, over his knees, to peer down at the unswept pavement between his feet. He'd already conducted a mental inventory of his pockets and knew he had nothing at all like a jeweler's screwdriver. Uncomfortably aware that he could be taken for a tweaker looking for hallucinatory fragments of crack, he conducted a focused survey of the ground. He noticed, and as quickly rejected, an inch-long shard of brown bottle glass. Sawing through the tie was at least a theoretical possibility, but he had no idea how long it might take, or really if it would work at all, and he was also afraid of cutting himself. A paper clip, after what Brown might have called field expedient modification, might do, but in his experience you didn't find paper clips or wire coat hangers when you needed them. But here, a few feet beyond the tip of his left shoe, was something slender, rectangular, apparently metallic, glinting faintly. Getting a grip on the armrest with his captive hand, he swiveled awkwardly off the bench, extending his left leg as far as possible and scraping repeatedly over the object with his left heel as he attempted to bring it closer. The fifth or sixth scrape did it, and he was able to snatch up his gratifyingly rigid and narrow prize with his free hand, returning quickly to the bench and a more orthodox posture. He held it between thumb and forefinger, like a seamstress her needle, and studied it carefully. It was the broken clip from a pen or pencil, stamped tin or brass, and rust flecked its cheap plated finish. Very nearly perfect. He checked its tip against the small opening through which he intended to dislodge the invisible ratchet. Too wide, but not by much. He found a particularly rough section of cast iron on the side of the armrest and went to work. It felt good to have something to do with his hands, or anyway, hand, on a summer day. "Man the toolmaker," said Milgram, filing away at his fairy Houdini shiv.